Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. Tonight, we're going to hear a really important memoir by a man who was right there when one of the most bizarre incidents in the history of American university life ever happened. And it happened right here in our own valley some 41 years ago. The person I'm talking about is Gene Zumwalt, who in 1970 was the chairman of the English department at Fresno State University. Since that day, a lot has happened to both him, his family, the university, and yes, our country. He entitles his story, Beyond the Roses. And here he is to read it for us. Ladies and gentlemen, Gene Zumwalt reading, Beyond the Roses.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Beyond the Roses. The dean entered the outside door of my office at the appointed time, 3 p.m., followed closely by a burly officer and a man in coveralls carrying a bag of tools, a length of 2x4, and a metal plate with a bolt welded in the center. They pushed into the center of the small office, already crowded by Bob Billings and Russ Leavenworth, past chairman of the English department, and Roger Chittick, associate chair, invited to be present at what promised to be a significant meeting, a banal academic meeting in an inconspicuous office of a temporary building so cheaply constructed it began to collapse and had to be condemned and draped with yellow warning tape long before the department vacated. On such a day, a Friday afternoon in 1970, in such a fragile place, the harbingers of petty fate came to order our lives. The recently appointed dean of the School of Humanities was a thin, spare man in good shape, I knew, because I had recently taken him fly fishing in the Sierras. I thought we had made a brief human contact. Ultimately, we were no more than flies caught in the race of currents, inevitable forces none of us could understand or control, a time when the Vietnam War was collapsing, minority groups were seeking recognition and justice, when faculties were moving toward union representation, and there was a strong conservative reaction to liberal initiatives. A float that had to take its course, that wouldn't tail out for years, for a lifetime, it turns out. He had spent his career in the music department, serving as chair, most recently offering courses in the guitar, though that wasn't his major instrument. As dean, he decorated his memos with dancing musical notes in the margins, belying the dictatorial strictures he laid on the department. He was given to talking about the harmony we should all embrace now that the university was under a conservative administration. The dean was dressed impeccably in a business suit. He carried a letter. The officer was a stranger, in a dark suit with a short haircut, heavy features, a scowling presence. I asked him to identify himself. He opened the front of his jacket to show a revolver tucked in his belt, grip protruding, ready to hand. He planted himself in the middle of the office, squaring his shoulders. The dean handed the letter to me, a short formal notice that I was being relieved of duty as chairman of the Department of English. I passed the letter to Billings and Leavenworth and asked for an explanation. Ignored, but a gesture indicated that we had the letter of dismissal. Enough. The man in coveralls, a locksmith, had squatted to remove the knob and lock assembly from the inner door to the main office. The bare wood hole stared at us. Through the hole, he thrust the threaded bolt. On my office side, there was welded a metal plate about 8 inches square. The bolt went through a hole in the 2x4 piece of wood, long enough to go from side to side of the door frame, so that when the nut was tightened on the bolt, the door was barred shut, the metal plate preventing any entry to the main office. A similar contrivance was bolted to the door of my associate chair, Roger Chittick, so that both of us were blocked from the main office. All of this was done with dispatch. The locksmith gathered his tools, the dean turned and left, and with an encompassing scowl, the officer shouldered away. At each main door to the department, one on either side of the narrow building, armed, uniformed officers were stationed. Below the balcony in the street was a squad car of armed police. Inside the main office was an armed guard with a walkie-talkie. On the flat rooftop of the adjacent science building, officers armed with rifles overlooked the back door, balcony, and stairs down from the department. Inside the office, heavy chains were draped around each of three file cabinets, secured with brass locks. A crowd of people pushed into the office. My secretary sat stunned with her hand over her mouth. A student bent over my desk, pointing at the phone, asking, "Is this phone bugged?" Faculty ran down the balcony, clutching files to their chests. Very athletic crew-cut men appeared and demanded any files or papers we had. I gave them a file detailing the acts that had recently occurred on campus involving the department. People were running on the inner balcony and stairs. There was a clamor of voices, indignant, scared, confused. The English department of Fresno State College had just been invaded by armed force, the first and I suppose the only such incident in American history. The takeover was accomplished quickly and with military precision, and it was clear the operation had been carefully planned. We learned much later that for weeks people had visited the offices, studying floor plans, entrances, the whole layout, so they knew exactly what to do. The individuals who did the surveying were colleagues from other departments, people we had known as friends for years. One of them, from math, who soon became the dean of science, said that he cooperated because he thought he could do more good for his school inside the administration. Another, from geography, with whom I had worked in faculty association matters, also became a dean. Ironically, a couple of years later, he was deposed by the administration as well, for they took to devouring their own. Inside the offices, people crowded, talking loudly, gesturing, some crying. Outside, a large crowd had gathered in a ragged circle around the building, standing back, silent, some incredulous, others amused. Apparently, word of the takeover had gone out, and at least some individuals came for the pleasure of watching the members of the Department of English flushed out of their warren of offices, scattered, helpless. Inside the circle, in spite of the noise of excited conversation, there was a deeper silence, a sense of separation. Something fundamental and irrevocable had taken place. The news of the takeover soon became nationally known. Reporters called the office and my home for days, and I repeated the story until I could not bear to answer the phone. We assumed the phones were bugged. Later, when I officed with Roger Chittick, on occasion he would tip back in his chair and talk loudly to the register in the corner of the ceiling. "Screw you, Norman Baxter, and the horse you rode in on." Baxter was the president who had ordered the attack. He served for two or three more years, but was finally let go by the state administration. Slowly, I gathered a few papers and books and left the building. The guards were at the doors and inside. The department was closed down and would stay that way for 3 days. No mail was delivered. Colleagues from other departments visited to see the scene for themselves, stopping for a while near the guards, shaking heads, muttering. There was general dismay in the faculty over what had happened. One chairman resigned in protest, but nothing was done. The conservatives controlled the faculty senate, and the general faculty were cowed by the clear evidence of how much police power the administration was willing to use to silence dissent. I walked home across the campus, the familiar paths, the fountain splashing in the sun, students crowding the grass and pathways, the Italian stone pines in solemn rows, all the same, but somehow irretrievably different. A landscape skewed, shifted, tilted to reveal the darkness that lay below, within, the cruelty and viciousness that walked in formal suits, the evil that is always there, controlled, if it is, by law, convention, and social proprieties, common decencies, but always ready to emerge when the political and social situation shifts to allow it to surge up and spread corrosively. I walked the paths toward home, carrying my incredible news, walking through the bright sunlight, the cries of kids throwing balls, skating, knots of students sitting in the grass talking, studying, getting ready for class, living their lives with little knowledge or understanding of what had happened, what was happening around them. I walked then, as I did for decades afterwards, through the bright, cheerful life of a student campus, seeing the places where actions had occurred, the ghosts of the actors in those events, the troops of armed police, the plainclothesmen carrying bags of weapons and tear gas, students with clubs and iron bars, tough plainclothesmen pushing individuals aside. I saw all of that and more because it was then, remained, and still is, a massive ball of events in my consciousness, intertwined, writhing, indissoluble, a congested totality difficult, perhaps impossible to analyze, to separate, to understand, to find some resolution for, acceptance. Only time, I thought, endurance through time, not a virtue, only a pain necessity. I still hear the incredulous murmur of voices in my office. I hear running on the balcony. I see the satisfied smirk on the dean's face, the arrogant twist and shift to the detective's shoulders. And I wonder, what? What happened? How could it have happened? What were the consequences? How can I explain to others what happened? When they laugh and shrug incredulously. Riflemen on the roofs, chains, bars and plates on the doors, a military attack on an academic department, surely a fantasy, an exaggeration, sheer delusion. So I have told people only fragmentarily. I have resisted until now writing about it. I one day opened drawers of files recording memos, disputes, fights, meetings, all the miserable little incidents of fact, person, and place that made up that reality. It was a burden, a shadow over my life. I wanted to have done with it. I emptied files and threw all that paper away, all those records of pain, loss, defeat, and disillusionment into the waste bins. But not the memories, not the voices and sounds and smells and cries, not the sense of desolation and defeat, not the anger, not the knowledge of the world, not any of it. It has always been there, lodged in my being, suppressed as far as the family, largely, and world could know. But there, while my children have grown and moved on, my wife, their mother, dead, unforgiving, many of the people involved dead, gone, forgotten, my career lived to the full end of 40 years at the college, into retirement in the mountains, surely a place to forget, vegetate, set type and rebuild old boats, surely. But it is still all there, boiling to the surface like that pot of incandescent metal in the smelter where I worked during grad school, boiling up with a seething inner force, threatening to boil over the pot edge, but controlled, pushed back down into the pot, smoking. Maybe it's time to tip the pot. I do so without pleasure. I don't pretend objectivity. I want only to say how it felt to me, what I saw, understood, and know in my bones. I know there are other views. Let others write them. Let others rise from the grave to say, that's not the way it was. That's not what we did. We meant well. Let the ghosts say what they will. After the takeover, we tried to deal with the consequences. At home, the phone rang incessantly, reporters calling from all over the country. Friends sent me news clippings from the East Coast, New York, Washington, D.C. We assumed the phones were bugged, but I talked openly anyway. Once a squad of four plainclothesmen parked for hours in an unmarked car at our curb, huddled in the heavy shade of a mulberry tree. In a residential neighborhood, they were conspicuous. I finally went out, inquired why they were there, and asked if there was anything I could do for them. The man in charge muttered something about police duty, and a man in the back seat, sweating in the heat, disturbed and angry, leaned forward to say, "Why don't you tell him?" The guy at the wheel just growled and shook his head, saying nothing. Soon they drove away and didn't return. One call came in from back east from an old student. He had been in my writing class one semester, maybe two. He was a giant Italian with a grand personality, open and enthusiastic, voluble in class. He was fond of writing about trips to the old country, where relatives plied him with red wine and tried to fix him up with a wife. I went with him once to a vineyard where he fell on his knees in the sand and let handfuls of soil run through his fingers. He wrote about experiences in the city when he had been fired on, and it gradually became apparent that he came from some kind of mob background and was in Fresno to cool off. He was studying to be a teacher, and I was able to help him with some of the paperwork. He was a pleasure in class, and I became fond of him as a student. When he called one morning, he said, "I hear someone is muscling in on your turf. I have a plane reservation, and I'm on my way to the airport. Give me their names." I asked him if he had some kind of influence in Fresno, and he laughed. "Give me their names," he said. "We're trying to handle everything legally," I said. He laughed. That's the last I heard from him. I felt then, and have always felt, that I passed through a crucial existential moment, and I have been glad. My friend Dale Bush wrote the manual for consultative procedures governing faculty and administrative processes on the campus. We followed those procedures. But during one holiday, President Falk erased almost all of them from the campus manual while the faculty was gone, without faculty participation or agreement. In our functions in the department and across the campus, we did everything legally. We defended liberal values that had been the hallmark of the state colleges. We helped to develop the experimental college and the La Raza and Black Studies departments. We fought hard to defend faculty under attack from increasingly conservative administration, trying to purge what they saw as liberals and radicals. We lost one such case, defending a black writer who went on to a long career at Rutgers. We won another bitter case, defending a faculty member who was fired and then undercut by the dean, who attached to his records a statement urging anyone who might consider hiring him to call the dean first. When every potential job opportunity collapsed, it was discovered what the dean had done, contrary to clearly defined state law. The faculty member was reinstated, paid damages, and the dean on his own, abandoned by administration, had to fight a costly legal battle to defend himself. That we behaved legally is evident in the fact that no legal charges were brought against us. But we faced administrations not so scrupulous. The campus police reported to the president and were corrupted to the extent that they were used as a force against the faculty. They developed a secret file of liberal faculty. They were involved in surveillance, and they were directly involved in the armed invasion of the Department of English. Norma, my wife, was miserably unhappy, upset by what had happened. She assumed and said that it was all my fault. I had brought the whole business on us. Neighbors and colleagues were distant and circumspect. Shopping at local markets became difficult and embarrassing. If we paid by check, there would be exclamations at the name. The clerk and the people in line would immediately identify us and start talking about what had happened at the university. Surely, they thought, and reasonably enough, there must have been something dangerous and illegal going on, or the authorities would not have had to intervene with such a major show of police force. Surely, something rotten was going on. She felt notorious, victimized, stigmatized. All because I couldn't stay out of trouble at school, sought it out, in fact, just to make her and the family miserable. She launched into evening tirades, increasingly profane, in which she indicted me for my list of crimes against the family, against her, against the peace and order of the university. Eventually, she attempted to commit suicide. She announced late one evening that she had swallowed every pill in the house. She was lapsing into unconsciousness. I called an ambulance. Before the ambulance arrived, the police were pounding at the door, pushing into the hallway, crowding down the hall to the bathroom and bedroom, seizing empty bottles, looking for evidence of a crime. Battery, perhaps. A murder. I protested innocence. They were skeptical. The ambulance crew arrived and wheeled her unconscious out of the house under the heavy gaze of the police. At the hospital, the doctors were successful in pumping her stomach and preventing the worst effects of the pills from putting her too far under. She was committed to a psychiatric unit in the hospital. She was pale, drawn, silent, washed out, and fatigued with an air of existential completion, the result of the deadly choice she had made. The nurse wrapped her tightly in blankets and told her to be careful that night. Males and females were housed together in the same facility. They didn't have enough security. She warned guardedly of the possibility of rape. For 3 days or more, I inhabited the waiting rooms and corridors of that county hospital until she could be evaluated and released, shaky, wan, weak, trembling, back into our life at home. She never attempted that again, but that she had made that choice, that attempt, was a reality we lived with, never spoken about, but remembered. A deadly fact between us. What had been going on with Norma and in our marriage was personal and private, and we both had responsibilities to carry. But the humiliation, the fear, the takeover of the department, my very public demotion and disgrace, the real possibility that I would lose my position at the university, all of it together was too much, a precipitating factor that helped to drive her to suicide. I know such events, emotional, psychological, spiritual, are complex and cannot be so simply resolved. I know that, and I accept my responsibility. But at the same time, have always felt, then and now, that what Baxter and his henchmen had done had been a major, immediate cause. I never spoke of the suicide attempt publicly. I never let Baxter and his people know. I didn't want to give them the satisfaction of knowing what a central destruction in my life, in my family, they had helped to precipitate. I held them, I hold them, responsible in whatever degree it is possible and fair to hold. As I try to understand, even now, I do not forget. Not after divorce and death and all the years, going on 40, I do not forget. At the same time all of this was going on, my son, Mark, nearly lost his leg. As events were coming to a head with the dean, Mark had had a sore knee, swelling, eventually diagnosed as a staph infection, the result of an old sailing accident. Because I was so deeply involved at the university and matters were obviously coming to some kind of a head, no one could imagine what, I didn't know when the diagnosis had been made that he had a major infection, his knee swollen to the size of a football, and that he had to be hospitalized. A friend in philosophy, my neighbor, took him to the hospital where they lanced his knee and drained a body of infected liquid. In the days prior to the takeover, I visited Mark in the hospital as I could get away from campus. Everything seemed to be falling apart. Mark had become involved in the political turmoil and in one way was partially responsible for the suspicions that hung over the department. As a student at the university, he had gradually become radicalized by political events and tensions. Protests against the war in Vietnam were becoming more intense. More and more students were involved. It was part of a national protest against the war, and it had become so politically sensitive that the Nixon administration had put hundreds, perhaps thousands of plainclothes officers on campuses. FBI, drug enforcement, we heard many stories but did not know for sure. We heard that there were 200 plainclothes officers, state and national, on campus. When I broached this matter to the administration, an assistant to the vice president from chemistry denied that there were any undercover officers, but later we learned that that report was not only true, but that the same administrator had been the campus director for such clandestine surveillance. No doubt, in the course of their surveillance, they learned that Mark had become a member of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, an organization that was becoming increasingly radicalized, perceived as leftist, perhaps communist, more and more rumored to be involved in violent actions. I didn't know for nearly 30 years that Mark had been involved in SDS. I have memories of Mark leading the candlelit procession of student grievance in commemoration of students who died at Kent State. Mark leading students to the athletic department at the gym to protest athletic department treatment of Hispanic students. Mark in the vanguard of students facing the gates of the utility yards, where the administration had absurdly holed up with forces of university, city, and county police. I suppose that it was reasonable for undercover agents to assume I was involved as well. But surely with the surveillance powers they commanded, they could easily have determined I was not. At some point, events blur now. President Falk, the former president, declared there were 50 members of the Communist Party among the faculty, and these individuals were taking their orders directly from Moscow. That charge was so preposterous that Alex Vavoulis in chemistry had black buttons made up with the numbers 50 in white. I still have two on my bureau. To mock Falk and the political hysteria that was becoming ever more tense and vocal. It was preposterous and untrue, but the fact that Mark was in SDS perhaps helps to explain in part the heavy police involvement in an armed invasion of the English department. Perhaps they expected armed, violent reaction. Certainly they expected to find incriminating papers in our office files, evidence of our link to Moscow, to the protests burgeoning across the country. When I protested, there were only official university forms in the files. They nodded knowingly. It became a political problem then, what to do about the heavy chains and locks on the files. They ended by getting three members of the conservative faculty, again, one of them became a dean in social sciences, to conduct the opening. They asked me to participate, and I refused, saying that if they were going to prostitute themselves by violating the integrity of the department for the administration, they could do so on their own. They did, solemnly, righteously. They only found and sorted university forms and records. They did steal the original of a speech plagiarized and delivered by one of the deans. We had been informed of the plagiarism and of the location of the original by the university librarian. No public report was ever made about the results of their search. But there were acts of violence on campus. A grand piano burned in the music department and cement poured into toilets. The English department was held responsible and publicly accused, the administration letting it be known that they had evidence to incriminate the department. When, as chairman, I asked to see the evidence to speak to people who held it, answers were ambiguous. The chair of the music department was defensive, mysterious, elusive, saying there was evidence. Members of the music department were involved in establishing it, but he did not admit to knowing where or what it was. Could I speak to the faculty involved? The answer was evasive. The faculty were not identified. I was never able to speak with them. We came to understand the evidence was on a tape incriminating the department. We asked to hear the tape to deal with what were, in fact, allegations of criminal behavior. We had the right to see and know the evidence and confront the people responsible. Answers regarding the tape were ambiguous and evasive. Its location was mysterious, unknown, or perhaps off campus. Yes, that was it. Finally, it was off campus and therefore not under the jurisdiction of campus officers who could not then legally require it to be produced. That the administration was depending on the tape to incriminate the department was clear, but they refused any responsibility to produce the evidence and continued to profess that they didn't know where, in fact, it was. In that climate, allegations were sufficient, and we began to understand that what was happening was neither ethical nor legal. We began to understand, but still, we were naive, not fully comprehending or believing the truth, not believing the administration and fellow faculty could behave in such ways. The mystery of the location of the tape was later solved. The tape had been kept in the desk of the president's secretary during the period when we asked to see and deal with it, when we were told it was not available, off campus, out of university jurisdiction. They kept it hidden for good reason, because it would not stand up to examination. It was plainly false, but that was never admitted, nor were we ever allowed to hear it or see a transcript of its allegations. The tape was made by a music faculty member, a director of chorus, who, it was said, had been approached by a graduate student with incriminating information. Together, they created the tape. We learned their identities eventually. The student had also taken courses in English, so his testimony was considered valid. The faculty member was tall, thin, always impeccably suited, a reactionary and voluble moral force among the conservative faculty. He was prim and righteous. We never got to confront either. What they had done was false, libelous, and it had a devastating effect. What the administration had done was a direct and deliberate lie about the location of the tape, but what was worse, they knowingly used false statements to issue damaging allegations which they allowed to stand in the public record. They were never held responsible for what they had done, though the grad student admitted the fabrication. When I later saw the faculty member on campus, he would turn and scuttle away into the crowd or down a hall, only his back retreating. These events were so preposterous that faculty in English consider them a joke. They did not take seriously the consequences of such false allegations, the damage done to the department in the eyes of the public and general faculty. The newspaper, the Fresno Bee, duly reported the vandalism. They never reported the dishonesties about the tape. They never investigated the curious role the administration had played in concealing yet using a spurious, fictitious piece of evidence. Though the newspaper was told in many ways what was actually happening on campus, it has never set the record straight. It didn't help that the poets in the department took to writing mock epic poems about the toilets and the piano. The poems were gathered and published in a small book. Clearly, the English department was cavalier and irresponsible in its behavior, not serious. How does an administration deal with such people? Well, one way to deal was to put spies in classrooms, part of that force of anonymous individuals swarming the campus. One such individual enrolled in my Chaucer course. He was a mature, middle-aged, athletic, well-spoken, articulate. He took part in class, and it has always been a pleasure to me that in the course he was required to learn to read Middle English. Not that difficult, but students often find it initially so. This person had to learn to read, to pronounce the vocabulary, to present to the class an individual analysis of a section of the prologue to the Canterbury Tales. He did a presentable job. Of course, it might be said that I have no documentary evidence that he was a state or federal officer, a spy. But he hung around after class and took part in any continuing discussions. One day after class, he approached me to offer to help in any way he could with my extracurricular political activities. Filing, typing, anything he could do to help, because he knew I must be busy. I declined and told him I didn't have such activities. I later learned that President Baxter was convinced that I was directing and controlling a web of student activities. This student did not complete or turn in the major research paper required for the class. He didn't take the final exam and so received an incomplete. But he could report to his superiors, truly, that he had learned to read Middle English. The existence of spies and plainclothes officers was common during the administrations of Presidents Falk and Baxter. Once I went to a meeting of department chairs with President Falk. Two plainclothesmen guarded the door of the room. When I protested to the group that this was a public university, a public meeting, that we could not hold free and open discussions under such circumstances, President Falk stared impassively at me. Nothing was done. No other chairman protested. The guards remained. Another time, I went to see President Falk in his office. Two plainclothesmen sat, one on either side of his main door, each clutching the inevitable plastic case of weapons and tear gas. Such people were visible all over the campus, at the corners, for example, of the balconies around the student union, overlooking the free speech area. There was, ironically enough, a free speech area with a small platform near the student union where people could mount the steps and stride the boards to make public statements. The plainclothesmen with their bags would always be there, and one day when I spoke to a small crowd on some issue, they were all around the stand taking pictures, holding up microphones, clearly obvious among the students. That was the point. They were seeking incriminating evidence, surely, but more than that, they were a deliberately obvious and heavy, intrusive hand of surveillance intimidating the campus. Overlooking the free speech area was one corner of the library, and the police put in a large surveillance camera to scan the area. Another such camera looked from the corner window of the student union opposite, so anything that happened in that area was filmed. Once, drawn to the area by a small crowd, I turned and started to walk down to listen in. As I walked, I saw a plainclothesman detach from the crowd and start filming my approach. I turned and left. The spies in the classroom were less obvious, but we knew they existed. The dean and the administration made public statements about the violation of the integrity of classrooms by English faculty making irrelevant political statements in class. We were warned against such behavior, the threat of official actions clearly implying the existence of a spying program. I was teaching an English upper division Shakespeare course at the time, my one teaching duty. It was my custom to spend an hour or so before class studying the play of the day in the library. I loved to hold up in the carrels located along the walls and the stacks, small desks surrounded and secluded by stack after stack of books. I would come each class day at about the same time, seeking out a favorite desk back near the corner. One morning, at the desk next to mine, there was a large policeman in uniform, I suppose with arms. He was so large he bulged off the small carrel chair, out the side of the carrel, into the aisle. He looked uncomfortable, out of place. He was reading a magazine. After that, every day I came to study, he would be there, obviously bored, flipping through magazines. But he was there, massively so. Eventually, we came to acknowledge each other, and I said good morning to him as I settled down to work. Why, except for the obvious intimidation he should be there, was not clear. We came to understand later that the administration thought I was meeting students there, that I was the ringleader of students carrying out disruptive and violent acts on campus. The mainframe computer for the campus in the business building was bombed one night, and later a Chicano student was indicted, convicted, and sent to jail. The word was that he was a soldier carrying out orders, sacrificed for the cause, whatever that was. But the computer was damaged. On another day of wild turbulence with Chicano students marching in groups on the campus, large rocks were thrown at the plate glass windows of the library, shattering splinters down into the flowers along the building. I happened to walk through the area to a classroom in a building across from the library. I was confronted by a wild-eyed faculty member who threw arms in the air and cried, "Are you satisfied now?" On that day, I was teaching Chaucer. Partway through the class, on the second floor, there were loud noises of students crowding narrow halls, threatening shouts banging on doors and walls, and people told to get out of the building, that there were Molotov cocktails in the crowd. I never saw any Molotov cocktail, nor was one used, but it became an article of faith for the administration that Molotov cocktails were brandished. I asked my class to evacuate and to regroup in the quad at some benches where we could complete the class, and we did as best we could with students running this way and that across the quad. But when we left the building, crowding down the narrow stairs and out the double metal doors, I said hello to several Chicano students I knew. I was observed emerging with them, talking with them, and President Baxter was convinced that I had led the Chicano students on their rampage through the building, that I had orchestrated the violence, that I was in the building teaching Chaucer, and that I had continued and completed the class outside in the midst of the turmoil was never acknowledged. I was in the middle of it. I knew the students. I marched out with them. That I knew the Chicano students well was true. At that time and still today, the population of the San Joaquin Valley has been heavily Hispanic. In part, they were indigenous, a remainder of the Spanish population that followed the missionaries into California, settled the land, took the large land grants, some that still exist, like the Tejon Ranch, and governed California as part of Mexico until the struggles with Mexico ended up with the American seizure of the entire Southwest. Their existence is everywhere documented in the geography, the place names of California. The population was subjugated, Americanized, assimilated with the Caucasian population that surged into California. But the Hispanics have never stopped coming, and they had gradually built a near majority which has contributed mightily to the development of culture and wealth of California, especially in agriculture, and that was a key factor in the valley of those days. Hispanics were second-class citizens in treatment and prejudice. They were laborers, they were meant to be, and were largely unseen in the political structures of the valley. Certainly, they did not come to the university. I taught at Fresno State for 12 years before I had my first Hispanic student. One or two at first, then a trickle, but nowhere near the proportion of the population in general. Gradually, the faculty became aware of this social inequality and injustice and began to work to correct it. This was early in the liberal 60s in California, when the state colleges, to be the vast state university, had only recently been created, when there was a glad sense of promise and hope. There was a generous master plan for education. The future was burgeoning with plans, new faculty, new programs. We were going to open up the colleges to the population of the state. And in large part, that has been true, with the state college and university system becoming the largest college institution in the world. But at the time, it was promise and hope, palpably so. I became a member of a small group of faculty charged with the duty of seeking out promising Hispanic and Black students to bring on campus for a pilot program. Faculty came from a variety of departments, English, art, history, business, science among them. We called the effort Project 17. Maybe there were only 17 students at first. At any rate, the first group was small. We advertised, we looked everywhere for promising students, and we sought especially individuals who had somehow distinguished themselves as potential leaders. They were to be the vanguard of an ever-increasing flow of minority students until, ideally, the student population would reflect the general population of the state. Everything was tentative at first. The students were frightened, intimidated by a college that had never been the ground of their people. We faculty were very conscious of opening up a new door, of teaching minority students, not just students, young people, but minority students with a heightened, no doubt prejudiced sense of what that all meant. But we were idealistic. We worked hard, the students responded, and the initial program was a success, to become far more of a success than we had ever imagined. For a semester or more, I was scheduled half-time as academic advisor for these students. More and more students came. They brought festivals of music and dance and colorful costume, but mainly they brought themselves, friends and family, and gradually came to know the university not as a foreign ground, an alien place, but their ground, their place, their future. I remember the excitement of assembled crowds of Hispanics. I can hear the wild calls of the Mexican vaqueros ringing out, a call here, answered there, the crowds chanting in unison, clapping in rhythmic bursts. With wild exhilaration, they remembered and reclaimed and declared what they were, what they would remain to be even as they entered and possessed this new ground. It was wonderful to see, to be a part of, and now there are literally thousands of minority students, perhaps a majority studying and accepted in every discipline. No one imagines a time when it wasn't so. But there was a beginning, and it was sometimes hard, sometimes dangerous. We sought them out. They came. They became a presence. They felt themselves to be a political force. They made a statement of their presence, their future, their determination to be an accepted and respected part of the university. It was to be their university in the best sense. But it wasn't easy. They were a threat to established values and structures of the university, what it thought itself to be, what was expected and approved by the traditional Caucasian populace entrenched in the faculty, the departments, the disciplines. It was especially hard in agriculture. After all, Hispanics, Mexicans, Chicanos, wetbacks, you name the prejudicial labels, and they were all used. These people were farm laborers, Mexicans, and they were coming to take over the School of Agriculture. The faculty and students in agriculture were Caucasian. The students came off farms owned and run by families for generations, the core of agricultural wealth and political power in the state. Deep fear and hatred among the faculty and students in agriculture was very vocal, constantly in the face of the Hispanic students. They were Mexicans, wetbacks, farm labor, the overflowing scruff of the labor camps that choked into the valley and populated towns like Five Points, Delray, Sanger, Fowler. They didn't speak English. You dealt with them mainly through labor contractors who joined farmers in exploiting them. They didn't need an education, could not handle one, would only debase the student body and erode academic values. We heard that argument often from faculty. Such people had no business at the university. They had no rights there. They were a threat to the university and the way of life in California. They were an invading mob, a revolutionary force. One day, after I had talked to an assembly in agriculture about the issues, a somber, defensive, unreceptive crowd, I was followed back to my office by a student carrying an iron bar. He wanted to debate, or rather, deny all the points I had tried to make. He followed me up the stairs, down the balcony, into my office, where he leaned the bar against my desk and continued to argue. At the time, we had hired a student to do part-time work in the main office. He was a bushy-haired, bearded Armenian giant who roared about the campus on a black Harley. He was gentle, really, but no one would know that from the enormous presence who walked in, sat down in my secretary's adjoining office, and pointedly propped the door open to listen, in reach of the iron bar propped between the three of us. The argument circled endlessly, aimlessly, until the student finally picked up his iron bar and trudged off, unconvinced. On another day, soon after, the campus electric in tension, groups of students, more like gangs roaming restlessly, the clear sense of some event hanging in the air, I watched from the corner of our balcony as pickup trucks lurched into the parking lot, loaded with axe handles, bars, too, I suppose, to hand out to ag students to defend their building. The word was the wetbacks were coming to assault and take over the ag buildings. Students and faculty were going to defend them. Of course, there was no attack. There was never any intention of such an act as far as I knew. It would have been an utter absurdity. What if there had been an attack, a pitched battle? What then? No one seemed to think of that. What was clear was that the agriculture community felt a clear threat to them, to established values in California, to the way of life as it had been, should clearly be. The ag students were joined in their fears, vulnerabilities, and aggressiveness by the athletic school. No athletes I knew about at the time were Hispanic. The main fear seemed to be that the Hispanics were a threat to athletics because they were beginning to ask for their fair share of scholarship resources. Clearly, monies given to minority students would reduce the funds to athletics, to real students, to an athletic program that even then had aspirations to be in Division I, especially in football and basketball. The assault on the ag buildings never took place. The crowds gathered to defend them gradually faded away. Students marched on the athletic buildings, but fortunately no violence occurred. Streams of tension came to a head one nervous day in the free speech area. The word was that the minority students planned to make a show of force, a quiet stand in a group, shoulder to shoulder, to let the campus know that they existed, they were there, they weren't going away, and they wanted to be respected and treated fairly. As they gathered and made their stand, clearly word had gone out across campus. Athletes and Aggies appeared, and the likelihood of a clash seemed real. Faculty from many departments linked arms in a long semicircle line to separate the groups. There were shouts and pushing from either side, but the line held, and eventually the volatile moment diffused, Anglo students walking away in small, angry clusters. The minority group stood solid until the end. We heard later that there had been weapons on both sides, but fortunately we were able to get past that moment. Tensions between the Aggies and athletes and their perceived foes, the minority students, gradually dissipated. Didn't disappear, but leveled out, because they were largely based on delusion and prejudice. There were no plans or acts of violent takeover. The minority students gradually melted into their roles as students. But the point had been made. They were a presence to be dealt with. Faculty meetings were held to debate issues and bring calm to the academic community. The minority student leaders were asked what their demands were, to their apparent surprise. They had mainly wanted to demonstrate their existence, their courageous determination to make a place and be a part of the campus community. But they came up with demands, and the campus did what it could to accommodate them, enough so that peace then and going into the future was a reality. But the general peace and order belied the reality of what life was like for those who suffered the invasion of the department, both before and after. The chronology of events is a chaotic, tangled ball in my mind, but it hardly matters, for life was then all of a piece. After the takeover, my teaching was shifted from the normal scheduling of English courses to mainly remedial classes. The administration offered to help me take a position as chairman at the University of Hawaii if I would resign. I declined. My life was at the university. I had tenure, a home, and children in school. I wanted to see it through. The court had declared that the invasion of the department was barbaric and that I deserved a hearing, but one never occurred. I understand that the case is now a useful body of precedence in California law, but I was so stunned by everything that had happened that I could not pursue it. Still, I was a marked man. Many faculty and nearly all of the administration ostracized me, never being seen talking with me in public. One vice president, a Mormon, approached me by the Rose Garden to say that he was resigning to take a position directing education matters for the Mormon Church in Salt Lake. If I were ever to come to Salt Lake, he offered to give me a behind-the-scenes tour of the temple. I appreciated that. My closest friend in the department announced one day at a department meeting that in the future my problems were my own, never mind that I had never done anything as chair not authorized by department vote, and the department needed to separate itself and go its own way. Maybe that was true. I got up and walked out. The department was never the same again for me. I put my head down and went back to teaching, a pleasure and a relief. But I was still marked. If I met a student at the restaurant, people, plainly not students, crowded in next to us to listen. In one course, the class was regularly interrupted about 5 minutes after starting by a man dressed in a bright blue suit who would open the door wide and look in, clearly to check if I were still there. After class, waiting in the hall, he followed me to my office. None of this was surreptitious. Whoever was responsible wanted the surveillance to be obvious. On another occasion, the department changed the scheduling of a course to a different time and room. Soon an official letter came to the chair declaring action was going to be taken because I was not attending and teaching my course. The chair was outraged by such keystone cop incompetence and made a protest. Perhaps in embarrassment, that kind of surveillance stopped. But eventually the campus calmed, the Vietnam War ended, students became apolitical, the university returned to what appeared to be normalcy. Conservative faculty who had for years ostracized me began to seek my advice in personnel issues. I served on the Academic Policy and Planning Committee as vice chair. I served two terms in the Academic Senate. At last, I was the oldest teaching faculty member, at least who could still walk, and for 4 years I led the faculty procession into graduation ceremonies, wielding the traditional mace. Somewhat reluctantly, I marched because I wanted to show that we were still there, that we represented certain values, that we could survive even armed intervention. We could do so because we had academic disciplines. We could and did return to teaching and academic life. Amusingly, I was always met, as the procession left the stadium, by a burly but genial former hammer thrower who carefully but firmly retrieved the mace as if somehow I might abscond with it, as if I needed such a physical symbol. Years later, now, going on 40, soon a half century, it seems absurd how long ago, yet still present, all those events are. When occasionally I walk on campus, the paths are well tended, arcing in peaceful curves, the trees have grown and filled out, the flower beds raked and edged, the rose garden still blooms in its long block of color, a constant reality of the past, a physical connection. The students seem young, very young, and peaceful. The faculty young, strange, with that old preoccupied air, going off to classes, to meetings, to hide out in the library. The light still glitters in the fountain, and students laze or meet on the benches around. Everything seems fresh. New people, new flowers and plantings, trees becoming large enough to make the old spaces seem not small, but somehow contained, ordered, as if nothing dramatic or dangerous could have ever occurred there. The people who pass are not aware of any of that, as if it had not occurred. But of course it did. It won't go away through time, or administrative denial, or the passage of generations. The old places and figures and actions are still on the ground, in the air, ghost figments superimposed, intermingled, tangled, the forms pushing each other through the same crowded spaces. I can see them all clearly, each event and place in action again. I see students running, squads of police, city and county, plainclothesmen with plastic bags of weapons, the ubiquitous cameras, the posters, the ominous air that something was going to happen, that it was happening, that it was somehow beyond us all, yet acting through us. Of course, in ways it was, because the issues were national, social, international. The war was an international event, beyond us, yet present, conscious. The anti-war movement was everywhere, it seemed, lines of conscientious objectors standing silently, heads bowed, one person at first, a philosophy professor, standing alone, then slowly another and another until at last, after weeks, a long line of individuals made silent protest, witness against war and pain and injustice. But the national and state administrations had flooded the campus with agents, and they were a dangerous, evident force among us, like the white-shirted, muscular, athletic man who seized a camera out of the owner's hands, objected to being photoed, identified, ripped the film out, and moved on, galvanized, untouched, untouchable clearly. I see such figures in the lines of faculty arms linked against violence. I hear the crash and splintering of plate glass in the library windows, brittle in the flower beds, shards of the life we had known and tried to build and live, splinters glinting in the sun. I hear boots on the balcony, running, echoing, and they echo still, though building and balcony are now long gone, torn down to leave a stretch of grass, green, cool, peaceful. I see the administration and police locked in the maintenance yard, their headquarters against student violence. It's impossible to imagine the paranoia that fueled their collective banding against the students, the faculty, the very campus they were appointed to lead. But they had the guns and the police and the forces of community and law, no matter how perverted, warped. They were the people of guns and armed guards and steel-plated doors, false tapes and witness against perceived enemies. They were authority, and they made it stand, wiped out enemies, destroyed careers, in a battle in which there were no real enemies, only the paranoia of power, of a conservative righteousness that would set all right, button up suits, knot ties, plant flowers and masses. All of that is still there, a reality past, a reality potential. Pick up a rock, and it swarms up and out, empowered, buttoning up suits, creasing pants, taking power. As Chaucer would say, when Lucifer lifts his tail, they seethe out, swarming the world. Such people, faculty, deans, presidents, violated consultative procedures, violated laws, even the truth, not to mention common decency. Existentially, they were and are what they did. To that extent, the university was and is what was done in its name. A presence beyond the roses and tended walks and trees, beyond the tranquillities of a university life, beyond the carefully tended image of a university, a dark bloom once swelled up and overwhelmed normal academic life. A dark human presence beyond the roses.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
That was Gene Zumwalt recalling not only what happened to him as the English department chair back in 1970, but what happened to the university where he was teaching. As you might know, the year 1970 pretty much marked the height of the Vietnam War, and even though, as Gene stated, he might have wanted to forget all of what happened, experiences like those he described have a way of hanging on. As you heard, he recalls these events without pleasure, without trying to pretend objectivity, without a desire to justify or defend, only to let us know how it felt so that we too can get a feel for what he saw and understood. Whatever our own opinions might be, we have to admit that the closing of the English department at Fresno State on that Friday in 1970 is probably unprecedented in American history. Of course, those of us who were around at the time remember that the Vietnam War years were years of controversy. We experienced anti- and pro-war demonstrations, protests, rallies, sit-ins, marches, teach-ins, even serious riots. In Gene's case, what happened not only affected him professionally, but sadly also invaded his private life. At this point, maybe it's fitting to remember the last few sentences of Gene's memoir tonight. Quote, "To the extent the university was and is, what was done in its name resulted in a presence beyond the roses and tended walks and trees, beyond the tranquillities of university life, beyond the carefully tended image of a university, which resulted in a dark bloom that once swelled up and overwhelmed normal academic life, a dark human presence beyond the roses. Friends, at this point, I think it's proper to recall that a couple of seasons ago, Gene Zumwalt read another memoir of his on Valley Writers Read about his being a fighter pilot in World War II. We recall that he participated in 27 combat missions flying P-38 fighter planes out of the boot of Italy into Yugoslavia, Austria, even Nazi Germany itself. Nowadays, he lives up in the foothills near the little community of Toll House. Besides doing a lot of fishing, hiking, and camping, he runs a small publishing house where he personally works the printing presses. Thank you for your important story tonight, Gene. We look forward to more of your writing in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Evelyn O. Lang. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.